The Tom Woods Show, episode 744.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, The Tom Woods Show.
Hi everybody, Tom Woods here, talking today about a very, very important Marxist thinker. He's no longer with us. His name was G.A. Cohen. And he's an interesting guy to talk about because he really tries to take egalitarianism as far as it can be taken, while at the same time acknowledging the difficulties of that position, acknowledging that there are some moral problems that seem to arise when it's applied, let's say, absolutely consistently. And also, I think he treats the libertarian self-ownership principle with respect. He doesn't caricature it. He's not ludicrously ridiculous in his treatment of it. So he's somebody worth reckoning with. He was a very, very significant figure in his lifetime. But more important than the man himself are the ideas. And these are ideas worth knowing about and reckoning with. So that's what I'm dedicating this episode to. And I'm actually taking this episode from the course I created for the Ron Paul curriculum. This is the course in particular that I created on government. This is a 90-lesson course, and this is one of those 90. And the course covers all different things. It covers political thought, covers different types of government, covers different types of government policy, all kinds of things. All kinds of propaganda is unwound in this course. It is like 20 years of learning on my part that I distilled into a one-semester course. So you can save yourself 19 and a half years and start winning those debates you know you should be winning, but for some reason you keep losing them against people who are arguing with you in bumper stickers. This is the remedy. So I'm going to link to that course at tomwoods.com/744. You can also find it at tomwoodshomeschool.com. If you want to just, you don't want to join the whole Ron Paul curriculum, you just want this one course, that's why I have tomwoodshomeschool.com. That'll be linked on the tomwoods.com/244 show notes page, 744 show notes page, sorry. Oh, what a week it's been. And anyway, just go to the show notes page. You're interested in any of this, that's where to go. tomwoods.com/744. I'll have a few related episodes up there as well about John Rawls, because I do mention John Rawls a couple of times in this particular lecture. Then also, after this is over, at the end of the episode, I'm going to talk about the next few episodes, because we have a very important one coming up next week, so I'm going to talk about those. So stay tuned for that, and here we go. Hi, everybody. It's Tom Woods, and today we're going to continue our discussion of critics of liberalism by looking at a Marxist scholar named G.A. Cohen. Now, we won't be talking about Marxism until a little bit later in the course, so I'm not going to assume that you know all about what Marxism is, but I will use the word socialism, and we have encountered that word already earlier this week. Cohen belongs to a group of thinkers, or belonged, he died in 2009, called analytical Marxists. These were people who believed there were some difficulties, some problems with classical Marxism, and so they were going to modify it to make Marxism more attractive and more plausible. As I say, we'll talk about the tenets of Marxism a little bit later on in the course, but for right now, we'll use the word socialism, which you're familiar with, and we're going to say this. In the classical Marxist scheme, it was understood that socialism was bound to come about. Capitalism was bound to be replaced by socialism. This could not be avoided. This was inevitably going to happen. And when we talk about Marxism, I'll explain why they thought that. Cohen, on the other hand, did not believe that. He did not believe that Marxism was absolutely bound to take place. It was bound to replace capitalism. Because the traditional Marxist would say, there's no point in arguing why socialism is superior to capitalism, because socialism is going to occur anyway. Doesn't matter what you think about it, it's going to happen. We're going to have socialism eventually. So it's pointless and a waste of time to sit around talking about the advantages of socialism over capitalism. But since Cohen did not believe that socialism was bound to come about, he felt like he did need to talk about what makes socialism desirable? Why should we want to bring about socialism? And his answer is that socialism is an ethically better system than capitalism. Capitalism produces inequality. and socialism brings about equality. And so that's why we should favor socialism. So he favors equal outcomes. That's the type of outcome he wants society to yield. Equality for everybody. Equal resources for everybody. Now, the thing about Cohen, though, is that he also believed that the idea of self-ownership that we looked at when we talked about Locke and Rothbard was very compelling, and that it was very hard to deny the idea of self-ownership. So Cohen is a Marxist, but he also is very attracted to this idea of self-ownership, that I own myself, that there's nobody in this world who has a stronger moral claim to exercise authority over my body than I do myself. And to indicate the strength of the self-ownership argument, Cohen talks about eyes, your eyes. And he talks about the idea of an eye lottery. He says, now think about it this way. He says, imagine that we've got a world of people, as we do now, and most people have two eyes. But then imagine that we have blind people, which indeed we do. And let's imagine that curing blindness was just a matter of plucking out a seeing person's eye and handing it to a blind person to just stick in the old eye socket. I mean, let's just imagine for the sake of argument that that's what blindness was. Blindness was a lack of eyes, and being able to see was something that came to you because you had eyes. So he says, so imagine we have this world where blindness occurs because people have no eyes. He says, now, if we believe only in equality, that's our only principle, and nothing overrides equality, then it seems like we should favor plucking out one of the eyes from people who can see and giving it to a blind person. Because if you have two eyes and one of your eyes is taken away, you can still see. Now, your eyesight is not as good as it would have been with two eyes. Your depth perception will be shot completely, but you can still see. I mean, it's a big inconvenience to go from having two eyes to one eye, but at least you can still see. But now think of the difference between having no eyes at all and having one eye. This is a dramatic improvement in the lives of in the life of a blind person. Going from not seeing at all to being able sort of to see. That's a huge increase in that person's well-being. Whereas the decrease in the well-being of a two-eye person going down to one eye, oh yeah, your well-being is worse, but that decrease is much less than the increase in well-being that comes from going from having no eyes at all to having one eye. So therefore, we should redistribute eyes. Maybe the government should have a lottery where all the people who have eyes should put their names in a hat, and once in a while we'll pull out a name and we'll say, Joe Smith, you have two eyes, you have been chosen, one of your eyes is going to be taken away and handed to a blind person. Now, would we favor this? He says, certainly we would all recoil from this. We would say, no, of course we can't favor this. And why is it that we would not want to favor this? And he says, well, it seems to be because we believe in self-ownership. That, yes, I suppose if I wanted to help a blind person, that would be my decision. I could decide to pluck out an eye and hand it to a blind person, but that would have to be my decision. The idea that the government or anybody else could come up to me and say that it would improve the overall well-being of the world if we took one of your eyes, you can still see, and we gave it to a blind person who now goes from blindness to sight. He says, we can't accept this, he says, because we believe in self-ownership. That I could make that decision about my own eyes, but nobody else has the right to. Even if giving one of my eyes to somebody would make somebody else better off. So he's drawn to the idea of self-ownership. And this eye lottery example really brings home vividly the consequences of not believing in self-ownership. If you don't believe in self-ownership, then maybe society could come and take one of your eyes and give it away. Now here's the puzzle that Cohen needs to solve. He likes the idea of self-ownership, but self-ownership seems to suggest the right to own property too. It seems to lead directly to libertarianism, and Cohen is a socialist. He can't believe in libertarianism. He believes in bringing about equality. And libertarianism forbids that, because libertarianism says that people have the right to their property, and you can't just come take it from them to make other people equal. If people want to make other people equal, they can freely give away their property, but you don't have the right to come take it from them or have the government come take it from them. So he likes self-ownership, but he's afraid self-ownership is going to lead to libertarianism, because self-ownership, according to Locke, implies the idea that I can take my body, which I control, and mix it with the goods of the world that have not yet been appropriated by anybody else, and I can make those things my own by my own labor being worked upon it. And then I own those things, and they are rightfully mine. You can't take them. And so government attempts to make people equal would be blocked, because the government would not have any right to take the property that I, a self-owning individual, have mixed my labor with and acquired for myself. So in other words, you go from self-ownership, that I own myself, to the principle that then I can take myself, mix my labor with something that has not been claimed by anybody else, and make that thing mine, and now I have some goods that I have a right to and defend. Well, the problem is, Cohen can't accept that. His view would be that property is something that can be taken and redistributed to make people equal. But if I have a right to property, you can't take it from me. So how does he stop self-ownership, from which he believes to be a reasonable, plausible principle? How does he stop it from leading directly to the right to property and libertarianism? And now, how can I bring about equality if everybody has the right to property and I'm not allowed to take it and give it to others? The argument against taking people's property and giving it to people who have less property seems just like the argument against the eye lottery. That, yes, I do, in a certain sense, have an extra eye. I have two eyes, and I could survive with one. So wouldn't it make people better off if the government could just take my eye and give it to blind people? It might, but you don't have the right to do it, because I have the right to my eyes. Well, likewise, wouldn't it make people better off if you could come take some of my property and give it to people who have less property? Wouldn't it make them better off? Well, yeah, just as in the same way that taking my eye and giving it to them would make them better off, I suppose if you took some of my stuff and gave it to them, they'd be better off. But you can't do that for the same reason, because I own this stuff and I have a right to it. The same way I have a right to my eyes, I have a right to my stuff. So it seems like it's the same sort of argument. If you're against the eye lottery, you ought to be against, in effect, the property lottery. You ought to be against government coming and taking property and redistributing it to people. So how is Cohen going to preserve self-ownership and not be led into libertarianism? And basically, he's got two ways of doing this. Your reading kind of, I don't understand why, suggests that he takes only one of these approaches. He takes both approaches. First, he shows that self-ownership does not, in fact, have to lead to libertarianism. And then secondly, he ultimately rejects self-ownership. He's gonna say, you know, it sounds plausible, but ultimately we have to reject this idea of self-ownership. So let's start with the first approach that Cohen takes, because the second approach, him rejecting self-ownership, later on he will say, I have to reject self-ownership because I believe that it tends to lead to inequality. And also he says that he comes up with a way that the eye lottery does not actually involve the issue of self-ownership. I'm going to leave that all aside. I'm going to focus on this other issue. He's going to show that self-ownership does not have to lead to libertarianism. John Locke's system that we looked at in our lessons on natural rights allowed for individual appropriation. That is to say, in Locke's system, an individual person could go to something in the world, a tree, a plot of land, or whatever, mix his labor with it, and say, from now on, this thing belongs to me. But Cohen is going to say, this doesn't follow. The world is not necessarily initially set up that way. It might be, but it doesn't have to be. Maybe people came together at some point in the world and decided that there would be joint ownership of all resources. And this would make it not legitimate for an individual to come along, mix his labor, and say, this thing is mine. Maybe mankind decided that all resources would be owned in common. Or maybe mankind decided that every individual would be entitled to an equal share of the resources of the world,
So it wouldn't matter if you mixed your labor with that land. Everybody's got to be given an equal share of everything. And maybe you took too much. So this is what Cohen is going to say. Because these alternatives exist, yes, Locke's alternative is possible. There could be a world where the implicit rules are that if an individual mixes his labor with land that nobody else has ever mixed his labor with, then he owns that land. That could be. But it's equally likely that the world, all the people in the world, decided on these other rules. Maybe they could have decided that no one's allowed to do that. That we all jointly own the world in common, and nobody can take one part of it for himself. So therefore, the move from self-ownership to libertarianism is not automatic. Because if you are not allowed to acquire private property from the world, then the idea that you have a natural right to property and the government can't come take it from you does not exist. So that's Cohen's line of argument. There are other ways of setting up the world that are equally likely as Locke's way, that individuals can come take stuff. Maybe they can't. Maybe individuals together came together and set up the rule that we all jointly own the world in common and nobody can do this. Now, there is here a plausibility problem, though, because the idea of joint ownership of the world by the entire human species leaves a lot of unanswered questions. So, for example, if the physical world existed before human beings existed, exactly when and how did all human beings acquire ownership of it? How could all the goods of the world be collectively owned before the collective owners, namely the human race, even existed? Or was there a point in history in which we see collective ownership coming into existence? If so, when? Like, we need some theory of showing how the joint ownership of the whole world by the human race arose. How did it come about? But Cohen doesn't give us one. How did it come about at some point in the history of the world, everybody came to own the whole world in common? You can't just say that. You have to try to show it. Was there a moment where everybody came together and decided on these rules? It seems implausible. So you would need to justify a statement like this instead of just making the statement. You'd have to show how this could have happened. And then, if it's true that the whole world is jointly owned in common, how could any one person use anything? Remember what ownership means. Ownership means you control something. So if the whole world is owned by all the people in the world, that means all the people in the world have a say in what's going to be done with every tree, every branch, every seed, every tomato. So how could I as an individual ever use anything? I would need to get the permission of everybody in the world. We'd all starve to death. How could we possibly get the permission of everybody in the world to eat a banana, for example? If the whole world owns the banana, who am I to use it for myself without consulting all the other owners, which would be the whole human race? Would we have to have the consent of our ancestors to use something? They're part of the human race. They are part owners too. Do we have to consider our great-grandchildren? They're going to also collectively own the world. There seem to be some insuperable difficulties posed here. Well, Cohen is going to try to deal with the objection that if the world is jointly owned by everyone, then I as an individual would need the permission of everyone in order to be able to do something. And therefore, no one would ever really be able to do anything because it would be totally impractical to get the permission of every single member of the human race. No one would be able to do anything, and so we'd all die. Now, Cohen answers this objection. He says, I don't think that's what would happen. He says, what people would realize is that we're going to have to come up with some system of distribution of the resources of the world. That yes, if you have to get the permission of the whole human race, then no one would be able to do anything. That's true. So he thinks that people would come together and devise a rule to determine who's allowed to use what. And he believes, Cohen believes, that the system that people would decide on would be a system of equality, that people would decide that everybody will get an equal share of resources. Now, why does he decide this? Or why does he believe that human beings would come together and say, the way we're going to divvy up the resources of the world is that everybody gets an equal share. and then you can use your share. You don't need to get the permission of everybody else in the world. Well, he thinks about it this way. He says, let's suppose that we've got a system where the world is jointly owned in common by all the human race. And then let's suppose the human race is split up into the more able people and the less able people. So we've got really productive people who work very hard, very talented. And then we have less productive people who don't work very hard and who aren't very talented. He says, now let's suppose that the more talented, the more able people said, all right, we're going to divide up the things of the world, but we're going to say that the rule is that the harder you work and the better you are as a worker, the more stuff you are entitled to. Now, Cohen says that if the productive people insisted on that system of distribution, that the harder workers, people who do more work, better work, who are more talented, those people will get a bigger share of the stuff. If the productive people insisted on that, Cohen says, then the less productive people would refuse to go along. They'd say, nope, we don't accept that. We want equal shares for everybody. And if you don't agree with equal shares for everybody, then we won't allow you to use anything. We won't give our consent. We're part owners of the whole world. We won't give our consent and let you work. We won't let you earn anything. We're just going to sit here. And so Cohen says, therefore, the productive people would have to agree, all right, we need the consent of the less productive people because they're part owners of the world too, and we need them to agree that we can use the things of the world. So, okay, we'll all agree that everybody gets equal shares. The problem with this argument is that in the same way that the less able people could hold out and say, nope, we're not going to cooperate until you agree on a system of equality, the productive people could also sit out. They could also hold out until the less able people agree to a system where the productive people and the people who work harder get more. Maybe the productive people could hold out even longer because the less productive people can't live without their productive work. So maybe the productive people could say, look, we're not going to do any work until you agree that we deserve somewhat more because we're doing all the work or we're doing most of the work. And so maybe the less able people would turn around and say, okay, we agree. Distribution of resources can be unequal in favor of the people who are more productive. So Cohen's thought experiment is indeterminate. That is to say, Cohen's thought experiment does not by any means establish that people originally would have agreed on a system of absolute equality, because he believes that the less able people would hold out for that system. What he doesn't consider is that the more able people could also hold out for a system of inequality. So Cohen's system seems not ultimately to work. Or at the very least, it doesn't prove what he thinks it does, that joint ownership of the world could be plausible, and that out of joint ownership of the world would come a system of equal resources that everybody would ultimately agree to. I also want to mention another aspect of Cohen's thought that's relevant to what we've been talking about. Cohen is critical of Rawls's difference principle. Now, we were sort of critical of Rawls's difference principle on the grounds that it seems kind of arbitrary to say that lucky people should just have all their stuff taken away that makes them greater than average, and so that they should be reduced to a condition of average income. We looked at some difficulties with that, or the idea that people who are more deserving than others ought to get more stuff. Rawls would reject that. But Cohen is going to criticize the difference principle from the other extreme. He's going to say it doesn't go far enough. Not that it goes too far in redistributing resources. Cohen's going to say it doesn't go far enough. Now, remember the difference principle. It says that inequality is allowed, but only if it benefits the least well off. But Cohen says, why should we accept this idea? He says, if the least well off could be said to benefit from inequality, wouldn't they benefit more from equality? He says, maybe the talented people in society don't require extra incentives to work hard or to do really difficult work that they are particularly suited for, Because remember, Rawls says that if we have absolute equality, then maybe people won't want to become, let's say, doctors, because that's a really hard job. And maybe people would just say, well, if you're going to take all my excess money, then I won't bother becoming a doctor. I'll pursue my life's dream, which is to be a gardener. That gives me much, much more pleasure than being a doctor. So I'll just go do that. Well, Cohen says, well, maybe the talented don't require these incentives. Maybe they'll just be generous people who say, well, I know being a doctor is really hard work, and I know that all the extra money that I earn over and above the average person is going to be taken away from me to bring about equality. But you know what? It's the right thing to do. So I'm going to go ahead and do all the work and work 12-hour days, and I'm going to be a doctor and be on call 24 hours a day. And I'm going to do that just out of the goodness of my heart. And I'm going to sit there while my excess money is taken away from me to bring about equality. And I'm just going to do this. He says, couldn't people think that way? And of course, they might. It's possible to imagine somebody who thinks that way. If they do need incentives, if they do need extra money to encourage them to go to the trouble to be doctors, couldn't they change? Couldn't society change them? Couldn't we educate them to think differently? Couldn't we educate them to think that equality is best? Why should we give up? Why should we say, well, some people are going to need incentives. They're going to need encouragement, special types of encouragement, like through extra money, for example, to do hard work. Well, maybe we just use society and use education to encourage them not to need encouragement, to encourage them to just believe in equality, to take the hard jobs that they're suited for, even though they're not going to get any extra income. Maybe we just educate them to think that way. Cohen goes on to say, if everyone gains from inequality, if we're going to take Rawls's view that even the poor gain from inequality because they gain from the extra work and from the hard jobs that the more talented people will take on because the more talented people get to be somewhat unequal, if everyone gains that way, Cohen says, wouldn't it be even better to reallocate the unequal gains, thereby establishing or preserving equality? So in other words, if it's good for the poor, for doctors to earn more than a garbage man, because then more people will be likely to be doctors and then the poor will get more medical care. If that's good, wouldn't it be even better to take the greater than average income that doctors earn, take that amount that's greater than the average and redistribute it to everybody and now make everybody equal again? Wouldn't that be better? Now again, we're faced with the same kind of question we faced before. What if the talented people won't act the way Cohen wants? Well, Cohen says they could freely choose to do so, and maybe some people might. They might say, yep, I'll go to the extra effort to be a doctor, and I'll have the income that I earn that's above average taken away from me because I believe in equality. And moreover, Cohen says, talented people generally have fulfilling jobs. So even if they don't get to take the job that they would prefer, they still will have jobs that are fulfilling. So David Gordon summarizes it this way. He says, a doctor who would really in his heart of hearts prefer to be a gardener should not abandon medicine. He should be a doctor even if he'd rather be a gardener, because work as a doctor provides a greater income that can then be redistributed to the poor. And it provides a service that the poor demand more urgently than they demand gardening services. So Cohen will say, it's true, I wouldn't require somebody to take a job that he absolutely hates, but in Cohen's ideal society, nobody can insist on working in their most preferred field. You have to work in the field that will benefit the poor the most. So yes, being a doctor, maybe you don't want to do it as much as you'd like to be a gardener. Maybe it's a lot of extra work that you'd rather not do. But if we believe in improving the condition of the poor the most, then you've got to take that job. I mean, you'll find it sort of fulfilling, Cohen assures you. So you've got to take that job of doctor, even if you'd prefer to be a gardener, because you'd make the poor better off, and there'd be more to redistribute to the poor. So that's an overview of the thought of G.A. Cohen. He is quite a challenging thinker, and he was a very smart guy, and he was fair to the freedom philosophy. He did not treat it ridiculously. He did not treat it with straw man arguments where he would make up arguments that libertarians never offered and then he would refute those arguments. He was fair. He was a rigorous thinker. his arguments may not ultimately hold up, but I wanted you to be familiar with them, that this is how somebody could argue consistently for thoroughgoing equality. These are the sorts of arguments that he would make. Thanks for watching.
All right, that's the talk from the Ron Paul curriculum course on government that I did. Find out more about that course at tomwoods.com/744 or at the site I created where you can get my Ron Paul courses a la carte. That's tomwoodshomeschool.com. All right, before I fill you in on the fun that's coming, our friend Mark Hamilton, who listens to the show, started a site that I want to tell you about because he started it through my link, so he gets a shout out on the show, hamiltontutoring.xyz, and you can be tutored in Latin and Greek. So if you're a classicist or you're doing classical education, chances are you have Latin and Greek, and there's a decent chance you're struggling with Latin and Greek. Well, what better way to deal with that problem than to be tutored by a listener of the Tom Woods Show, right? So hamiltontutoring.xyz is the place to go for that. I will be linking to it as the listener website mentioned at tomwoods.com/744. And remember, I've got a private group for all you guys who start blogs and websites through my link, so we can all help each other and get tech questions answered and stuff like that. I've got tutorials to help get you started. I got the shout-out. I got the link on the site. Great boost to get you going. So to get all those goodies, check out tomwoods.com/publicity. All right, next week, the key thing is that we've got the first of the presidential debates coming up. So Lou Rockwell will be coming back, and Lou and I will talk about the first debate between Trump and Clinton. So that will be Tuesday's episode, because the debate is Monday. So that means that'll be episode 746. So keep your eye out for that. We'll get that out as early in the day as we possibly can. And you'll have fun, I hope, listening to it. I'm going to tell you right now, I will not be able to do an episode on the second debate, because that's taking place October 9th, and that's the day that the Contra Cruise sets sail. I've been telling you quite a bit about that cruise that Bob Murphy and I are hosting, October 9th through the 16th, 2016. Well, that launches on October 9th, and that's the same day as the debate, so I won't be doing an episode on that, I'm sorry to say, but we will do an episode on the third debate. So the first and the third, Lou and I will do. So the first one's coming up on episode 746. 745 is an episode on the economics of fractional reserve banking. And episode 747 is going to be an episode that derives from something a listener asked me about. A listener said, hey, my friend said the following thing, and I'm not quite sure what a good zingy response is, that the middle class creates jobs because they're the ones who actually go out and spend money and they buy things at stores. And that's what really creates jobs, not rich people who shelter their income in the Cayman Islands. So we're going to tackle that in episode 747. So a lot of fun things coming up. Make sure you have subscribed to the show on iTunes or Stitcher. Very easy to do that. And I'll see you next week.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.